Hey everyone, just before we get into this episode, just a quick announcement. We have some new stuff on our web shop. We've t-shirts, some cool posters, and some signed copies of Matt's book, Painted People. So it's beneaththeskinshop.com and the link is in the description of this episode. Anyway, back to the show. Did you enjoy your pub lunch?
I did. Why do you know what I had for lunch, Tom? Are you following me around?
Yes, I have installed cameras inside all of your jackets. So like every button has a little camera in it.
I mean, the amount of weight that I put on at times, it's surprising you can fit some cameras in my jackets, but...
But no, we have a very...
Haha, we fooled you, listeners.
Yes, we are in the same room. You can tell by the incredible quality of Matt's mic.
Almost in touching distance.
Almost within touching distance.
Oh, I did laugh, Tom, that you said the other day when we got the new mic that it was going to sound amazing. And then Well, the drivers were playing up and it wasn't set up properly at my end. So actually, it sounded worse than usual.
Yeah. Maybe something's in retrograde. I don't know. But... You're very welcome to Beneath the Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. And me and Matt are in the same room. Yeah. Matt has come into my work and we are downstairs recording. We just had a lovely quick pub lunch in the Dove on Broadway Market in Hackney.
And then later on, we're going to wrestle.
Yes, nude.
You were saying we should do Beneath the Skin After Dark.
Yes.
With ASMR.
Yes, just like...
Maybe you could do like relaxation tapes or something.
I don't think I have the voice for that.
I definitely don't. It wouldn't be very relaxing listening to me before you went to bed, would it?
Yeah, because it would just you spiking the volume, just like a randomizer. And! But yeah, so.
You've just blown everyone's ears open.
Yeah, don't worry, I'll fix it in post.
Yeah. You told me you weren't going to fix anything in post today.
No, it's all live. It's all raw. It's coming to you raw. If you would have gathered that I am Thomas O'Mahony, one of your co-hosts, and I am joined by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matt Lauder, sitting 4 feet away from me.
Bonjour. It is a pleasure to be here. As I was just saying to you before we came on, it is a real pleasure to do the show with you, Tom, because I get to do fun things. And, this weekend we're doing a fun thing.
Yeah, we are at Brighton Tattoo Convention, booth 109. By the toilet. So if you need to use the lavatory, why not pop in and say hello afterwards after you've washed your hands?
Or before.
Because that is the perfect excuse, because Matt will talk for 20 minutes if uninterrupted or without you walking away from the conversation. So you could say, oh, sorry, I need to use the loo.
I did do a thing the other day with friend of the pod, Paul King. We did a little... anthropology conference in the US, where part of it was pre-recorded, and the videos were 20 minutes long, and the guy who was recording them said I was the only person that did 20 minutes without a break and didn't need to be recut.
Sometimes when we're recording this podcast, I wonder, when are you going to breathe?
There's no off on the genius switch, Tom.
But since we are going to Brighton this week, we decided we would do probably an episode that people have anticipated for a while. We're going to do a brief potted history of tattoo conventions.
Yeah, we are. And like, it's going to be very potted, and there's definitely more detail I think we'll do in future episodes where we can get into some more specific things in more detail. But basically I'm just finishing up my next book at the moment. It's sort of all the text has been sent to the publisher. I'm sorting out the images. It's still untitled. It's a history of the tattoo industry, basically. And a big part of that is tattooers getting together to talk to each other, and then tattooers getting together to show what they can do to the rest of the world and show off what they do. Show off what they do to the public, right? And not just public, but to the media, to TV, to magazine writers. And yeah, like conventions have been this really interesting way of, you know, the book basically charts this kind of emergence of the tattoo industry, kind of quote unquote out of the shadows in some respects from the early 1700s. And the tattoo convention, so to speak, and certainly the forerunners that we'll talk about today as well, are the ways by which tattooing and tattooers like come together and advocate for what they're doing. And it's a big part of actually the, you know, we joke all the time. I even say it's a nice meme now. I see people joking about it on the Patreon. But we joke, you know, about this kind of not just for sailors anymore story that's so persistent in tattoo history for the Western industry. But like the tattoo convention is a big part of that not just for sailors story, because it's a chance where anyone, even if you're not getting tattooed, you can come and see tattooing live, right?
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting in terms of its development over time, whereas like now it really marks tattooing being a quite mainstream industry as well. Like if you go to a convention like Brighton, you will see so many, you know, not just tattooers, but also retail spaces, events. And it's kind of, it shows that tattooing is just as much a culture and industry as it is an artistic medium now.
Yeah, exactly. And again, like a big part of, I mean, again, as we'll get into, I think, like tattoo conventions have been a way for, yeah, to kind of advocate for the industry, to kind of say, this is what we're doing. Take us seriously. We're professionals. We are, you know, we're not just these kind of back alley scratchers. We're serious artistic professionals who want to be, you know, taken seriously as pros. Maybe the first place, sorry, what was the first convention you went to?
Was Brighton last year.
No.
Yeah.
How come you'd never been before?
I don't know. It's like for a long time, my interest in tattooing was very singular and very individual. It was like me being into tattoos, going to get tattooed. And it was only, I suppose, like me not just doing the show, but also like trying to kind of cover it from a perspective of someone trying to understand it. That like, you know, I went to Brighton last year and it was just such an incredible experience. Yeah. That, you know, it made me want to dig into, you know, what are the differences between, you know, conventions in different countries, in different regions, you know, different times of the year, because it's kind of a year-round thing.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, I went to, I got my first tattoos done at a convention. I think I've told this story in the pod before. Like when I was younger, I got obsessed with tattooing. I didn't want to go to get tattooed in tattoo shops. And I sort of convinced myself from having seen tattoos in magazines and, you know, things like Modern Primitives and Tattoo Time, that I wanted an American tattoo, because the American tattoos that I saw in these publications were like so much better than anything that I saw my mates getting done in Essex. And so it wasn't until I went to a tattoo convention. I was living in France. I was working, doing a kind of year out from uni.
Le petit moi, oui.
Translating, working for a big industrial metal fabrication company in France. And there was a big tattoo convention out there in Belfort, which is sort of very interestingly placed on the sort of corner of France, Switzerland and Germany. I have a long-standing tattoo convention there. And I went, and there was an American tattooer there, a guy called Jack Mosher. And because he was American, I got tattooed by him. He was amazing. Turns out the things I got tattooed, just some black stars on my wrists, I could have got tattooed anywhere. But it was a real eye-opener for me. And I think the other thing as well, right, and this is maybe part of this story of tattooing emerging into the public eye, is that I had always found tattoo shops, and still do find tattoo shops, very emotionally intense places. And I told Alex Binney, for example, that I walked into Interview once, years before I was ever tattooed, and walked straight out again because it was so, so overwhelming. And I still find that, you know, tattoo shops are, for all their, you know, even the shiny, posh ones, are places of real kind of, you know, intense human connection. And I find that very powerful and very privileged spaces to be in. And so I don't know, for me, like going to a convention was like, it felt safer in a way, right? Because you could sort of go and you could be a bit of a, and I, you know, always was this kind of spectator of tattooing. I always wanted to go and watch. I was as interested in seeing people doing tattoos and learning about it than I was in getting tattooed initially. So for me, going to a convention was just this absolutely incredible moment of feeling like I could see what this was really like, you know, in a fairly kind of safe way. Although one of the first people I saw when I walked into this convention was a guy who had, in the old school days, this was 2000. Summer 2000. He had a big cut out from his shirt, which is what people used to do. You cut holes in your clothing to show off the tattoos you had. And this guy had a big back piece of a Confederate flag and a portrait of David Duke, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
And very funnily enough, there is like a TikTok that's going viral right now of like, just, you know, a guy saying, oh, average experience at a tattoo convention. And now it is based in the US, but it's like, that's a swastika, that's a swastika, that's a stars and bars, that's a rebel flag.
Well, I mean, I don't think, so I think that was a kind of particularly kind of, you know, French thing. And of course, like, again, as we'll get into, tattoo conventions have also had their...
J'aime le David Duke.
Have their, yeah, oui. Le racisme. Have always had their kind of mystique, but like they have always, since the very, very beginning of the modern era of tattoo conventions, been a way for non-tattoo people, the general public, to come and kind of come and see what the fun's all about. Mm. And that, you know, that's been some of the joy of them and also some of the controversy.
And also, you know, it has that kind of continuity with the history of very visibly tattooed people existing within, you know, traveling fairs and sideshows. It's kind of that, like, pay the price, you can come see them, but now is kind of mixed with this market stall, you know, setup.
Yeah, and I think what separates the tattoo convention from the tattooed performing thing is also the function for tattooists to get together. Mm-hmm. Because actually, if we think about the roots of this, and they're very contentious, and there are different kind of accounts. But tattoo conventions really begin as a way for tattoo artists
to
hang out. Yeah, and to and you know, in eras before Instagram, eras before tattoo magazines, it was a way for tattooers just to hang out, mm-hmm. right? So I don't know, like. Probably, maybe we can start with some of the history. I mean, certainly the things that inspired what would go on to become conventions are, I don't know if they necessarily count as conventions in the modern sense, because they don't have this kind of public visibility, but they were meetings of tattooed people and of tattoo artists in Japan. And so this is the meetings of, again, I've apologized for my terrible Japanese pronunciation before, but these are the meetings of the Edo Choyukai, the Tokyo Tattoo Club, basically, the sort of hard skin club, as they also get called occasionally, founded in the late 19th century. We did talk a bit about these with Pascal, when Pascal mm-hmm. Bagot came, who's also going to be at Brighton Convention, by the way.
We might speak to him at the weekend, maybe expect a couple of mini episodes edited together next week.
Lots of friends of the pod. But he came, as you remember, he came, if you haven't listened to that episode, you should do. He came on the podcast to talk about this guy called Akimatsu, who wrote a book about sort of a kind of thriller, murder mystery set in the post-war context of one of the meetings of one of these Tokyo Tattoo Club meetings. I mean, you've seen those photos, right, Tom? Like, you've seen those famous photos of these guys, mainly guys, almost exclusively guys, in bathhouses, often in onsen in Japan, like hanging out, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that club's been going since the 19th century. There are images of, even by Kunisada, of, like, you know, images of tattooed people hanging out. There are even more recent kind of pastiches of that from the 1950s of some of these members of the Edo Choyukai hanging out in waterfalls and undergoing pilgrimages. There's some nice interviews with some of these more kind of modern, certainly like 50s and 60s pilgrims, visitors to these regular meetings of the Tokyo Tattoo Club, where like, you know, some journalists will say, oh, are you all Yakuza? And this will go, look, do you think a Yakuza could afford this? You know? So there's something kind of important about kind of tattooed people meeting together in Japan.
And this is really like the bedrock of conventions, of them existing as this kind of meeting of community, like of not only tattoo artists, but tattooed people.
That's right. And it's also a kind of, it is a real kind of almost art appreciation thing, right? So there's a nice interview that Vice did with a recent kind of meeting, post-pandemic meeting of the Edo Chuyuke. And they interview this guy who says, Horimono can cost millions of yen and the salary of Yakuza is low. Aside from top bosses, the thought that every Yakuza could afford to put on their body is laughable. But he says, you know, members come from a wide range of backgrounds and professions. And yeah, it's basically a way for people to engage with this thing they love almost as a hobby, right? This guy that Vice interviews called Matsuda. I don't need society's approval. He says, I don't care if people understand or they don't. But it becomes this, like, I love tattooing. I want to be around tattooed people. I want to see people's tattoos, which particularly for this kind of Japanese back piece kind of stuff wasn't on regular display. So if you wanted to see it, you had to go and meet up. And onsen or waterfalls, places where you could bathe, were good places to kind of take your clothes off. And these become, yeah, these become this kind of spur. I mean, it's almost like a pilgrimage, right? Like these get described as pilgrimages, this Japanese group go to a shrine, to places like, you know, Mount Fuji. But what happens is, right, so in the 1940s, specifically in 1948, so like really sort of after the end of World War II, when Japan is full of Americans, you know, Japan's occupied by Americans from the end of the war until 1952, I think I'm right saying. And that means there's lots of American interest in Japan, again, you know, in a way that there had been a century earlier. And there's lots of American journalists embedded with the soldiers. And so there's a real whole series throughout 1948, 49, and 1950. There's a whole series of kind of articles, which everybody listening to, I'm sure, would have seen photos from, because all these photos that you would have seen have come from these articles, particularly one that was published in Life magazine in 1948 of the Edo Chuyuke meeting. You know, and they weren't long articles, they were mainly pictorial, but they were ways of basically like showing to the Western world, like, hey, this is cool, this is this strange thing that's been happening in Japan, and it's a way for these cool people to meet, right?
And also, like, after post-war, up until kind of the 1990s, there was this kind of couple of decades long curiosity of subcultures that were happening in Japan. You know, you have this, you have
the Bozozuku a bit later,
the Bozozuku, you have the kind of Teddy Boy revival in the 70s in Japan.
Yeah, and like this is again part of that kind of post-war oriental boom that feeds into a lot of stuff that comes afterwards. The other thing these meetings of the post-war meetings of the Edo Chuyuke have, and again, this is part of, again, of the Akamitsu book, is competitions. Mm-hmm. So people coming together and sort of being judged and having their tattoos judged. There's a great one of these 1948 articles, actually, which is in a Canadian magazine called The Sphere. It talks about, like, they hadn't been able to have any meetings during the war, so they were really pleased to see each other. They got really, really pissed and on sake, and they had to cancel the judging because none of the competitors could stand still enough to be judged. They were all too pissed. which tattoo conventions are still quite, you know, even start going to the conventions, you could drink on the convention floor, and that's not always the case anymore. But I love the fact that, yeah, like, from these very, very early post-war conventions where tattooed people are hanging out, they're too pissed to do the competition because everyone's too pissed to see or stand still.
And it's an interesting point, because tattoo conventions, and particularly competitions at tattoo conventions, are kind of one of the really close points where tattooing crosses over into the kind of contemporary art world, because you're judging a piece of art not only just because of its visual and artistic merit in terms of design, but also the form it takes, how it works with the body,
right,
as a piece of art.
We talked a bit about that as well when we did our first episode, on Continuous I Can't Bear It episode about the Ink Master series, where I talked a little about the history of tattoo judging, which comes from this same place. And they also actually, competitions, as we'll come back to, also become a bit of a point of conflict, because either it gets thought of as a popularity contest, and some create cliques. Some people think they're a bit self-congratulatory and they're not actually ways to talk to the public, but only to talk to each other. So the competitions also become a bit of a source of drama and conversation over the decades that follow. All of these ingredients: tattooed people, and judging, and like some press, but no general public really are present in these late 1940s Japanese meetings of tattooed people. Again, I don't know if we'd really call them conventions in the modern sense, right? But what happens next is those photos are published in places like Life magazine and Sphere and others, magazine in Australia as well. And they are seen then by UK tattooers and American tattooers and Australian tattooers and European tattooers. And they think, tattooing at this point, as again we've discussed before in the podcast, is really a bit of a low ebb. It's very stigmatized because it's associated with sailors. It's associated with stigma, with the horrors of forced tattooing during the Holocaust. And also it's going out of fashion. It's going out of fashion because the world is changing visually. Everything's becoming sleek and minimalist and modernist, and tattooing is a bit too fussy and not very in keeping with modern aesthetics. So tattooing is really kind of kept alive by the super fans in the early 1950s in the UK, for example. And the tattooers who are talking to each other through the pages of correspondence in the back of magazines like World's Fair, which is a magazine for sort of showmen and traveling circus performers, who had been since the 1930s, are saying, look, we need to put on a better face to the world, lads. We need to show something to the world. And so into that space, really, in the vacuum that all of that causes, comes Les Skous. And Les Skous and the Bristol Tattoo Club. Again, we will do a much longer and more involved episode about Skous and his influence, but a lot of his influence really comes through this, again, not quite convention, but something which is sort of proto-convention. So Skous, basically, he's like, in 1953, he's in his early 40s, but he's been tattooing for 20-odd years. He'd learnt to tattoo from Joseph Hartley in Bristol. So he's young enough to kind of have the energy and the vim and vigor to do it and to bring people together, but is also sort of being around long enough to have some gravitas in the industry. And he basically thought, like, I want to do this. I want to kind of, find my people. I mean, he did an interview in 1954, basically, that there was only 8 tattooers left in the country. I mean, there was like 8 good pros. There were plenty of scratchers around. I mean, this is a point that they make, right? They're like, there's a few of us that are good, but he says
there would have been him, Jesse.
Yeah, there is like there's like Jack Zeke and Cash Cooper. There's Ron Ackers, and not many more. There's a couple of other names, but those are the kind of core of this group. Rich Mingins as well becomes important. So he starts this club, the Bristol Tattoo Club, in 1953, basically as a initially very, very small thing in a pub in Bristol, right, where it's like literally half a dozen people, basically. But he says straight away to an interviewer, because he's quite canny, like a lot of the people that we talk about a lot to this day are tattooers who've really engaged with the press, and he was quite a canny kind of media self-publicist, Skous, as well as a great tattooer as well. But he basically said, I hope, quote, we could organise friendly competitions and it would help to raise the standard of the profession, one of the oldest in the world. Les Skous is a perfectionist, said the journalist. I have never been and never will be satisfied with techniques and equipments, he quoted Skous as saying, nor with my own ability and my own designs. So conventions are a way, as I said, to hang out, to bring people together. and to also kind of talk about what they're doing as an art form, really, to be taken seriously. Again, he says, the impression is only due to ignorance. Many people, he says, think tattooing is common and degrading, only being patronized by people of low mentality. It's 1954. The impression is only due to ignorance and lack of understanding. And the Bristol Tattoo Club has been able to promote more fair and proper appraisal of tattoo work among the general public. So yeah, the first meeting, which was artists and clients, although again, not straightforwardly members of the public, at a pub called the White Horse in Bristol. And then the following year, they moved to a space where they had about 60 people as part of the group. And then we get an immediate offshoot in London in 1955, which is, again, beginning to feel a bit more like a modern convention because, well, they advertise it in advance, interestingly. So Cash Cooper, for example, says to a newspaper, like, we're going to be doing some judging. We're going to have some judging. It's at this pub called the White Horse in Clerkenwell. Sorry, the horseshoe in Clerkenwell. We're going to be doing judging. They invite the Picture Post. They invite the Sunday Pictorial, these sort of big illustrated magazines. And yeah, they come together and you've got Jesse and you've got Les Goose. You've got Rich Mingins. And you've got a guy from America called Al Shafley from Sandusky, Ohio, who'd heard about Les through publicity about the Bristol Tattoo Club. And they decided to come to England. And they have this champion tattooer of all England competition in 1955, which Les, of course, wins. And Jesse Knight comes second. And yeah, that, I don't think it's quite a convention because it's a meeting in a semi-public place for tattoo enthusiasts.
Hey, are you enjoying the show? If you really like Beneath the Skin and you want to help support us, you can do so on Patreon. For little as £5 a month, you can help make this show possible, help us buy research materials. So if you like the show and you want to support us, consider kicking us a few quid a month and you'll get everything from bonus episodes to Q&As, and you can even vote on what tattoo I'll get when we reach a certain subscriber count. Matt, have you got anything to say?
You should really definitely fund the Patreon because tattoo history is massive, right? Deep, wide, complicated. We're covering some big hit topics on the main feed, but on the Patreon subscriber-only feed, we'll be getting into some really more interesting, niche, deep topics you don't want to miss out on. And honestly, the chance to kind of decide what Thomas gets on his body is probably just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Subscribe, chuck us a few quid. Don't miss out on the chance to ruin Thomas's body forever.
But one thing I think that makes this the perfect midpoint between the Japanese meetups and what we'll see going into like the early 70s is the presence of press. Like, this is being covered and reported on, probably due to the media savviness of some people involved.
Yeah.
And like, that is kind of a transformational element of the evolution from it happening in Japan. Now it's the Bristol Tattoo Club meeting in the Horseshoe in Clerkenwell, and what we'll see going forward.
Yeah, and that's right. As I said, it's for them, and this becomes really important and quite, again, a cause of conflict in a later part of the story that we'll get to. The telling a good story about the industry, that we are serious, we are hygienic, we are artistic and creative, we have a diverse, to some degree, client base. Like, that's conventions exist for that storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Bristol Tattoo Club is formed explicitly, as I said, you know, in those first interviews that Les Goose is giving to defend the industry at a time when it is really on its arse, right?
And I think it also talks a lot about, you know, tattooing's place as an artistic medium, in the sense that like every other medium has had its kind of point of defense where it's kind of its existence is being examined in a questioning way of like, well, what does this mean? And this seems kind of like a bulwark against that observation.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. And again, it's at a time when you are able, you know, there is a sort of birth of a mass media, the television starting and tabloid publications are becoming more so it actually is a way that you can tell the story you want to tell as an industry, which is perhaps at odds. I mean, one of the reasons that this not just for sailors anymore rhetoric is so prevalent is because that's the story that tattooers have been telling the press for so long.
And I think, you know, I think it is the cool thing about conventions and about tattooing in general is that it is, in their own mind, reinvented by every new tattooist that enters the industry. Tattooing only begins when they pick up a machine.
Oh, yeah.
And what they're doing is their own take on it. And I think it's what has sustained tattooing as a kind of community, an artistic form, an interest, a profession, is people getting involved and putting their mark on it. And at this point, this is Les Skou saying, you know, you have perceptions of what tattoos are, but this is what they mean to us, not just you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. It's this way of taking that, as you said, the voice that sort of is present in that, in those Japanese club meetings as well, of like, this is what we love and why we love it. We love it because it's strange and beautiful and romantic and exciting. And we're proud of it. We want to show you why we love it. Yeah, that's exactly right, man. So what happened? The following, well, there's another really interesting link at that horseshoe event in 55, and it's the presence of Rudy Inhelder, a young Swiss man who we've talked about on the pod before, so we won't go on at length, but this basically, Rudy is a tattoo fan who'd seen about tattooing due to a book that had come out in 1954, the year before. He'd written called Pierced Hearts and True Love by a guy called Hans Ebbetson. He'd written to Hans Ebbetson, so tell me more about that. He said you should speak to this guy in London called Rich Mingins, and Inhelder had written to Mingins. Mingins had invited him to London, and there's this young Swiss guy present in this space where literally there are photos of Les Skou, Jesse, Rich Mingins, Les Lone Wolf, Horsler from Watford, another tower from the era, who people may have seen, and Al Shafley. And this, you know, Inhelder's at that meeting, right? And he's absolutely captivated. The Bristol Tattoo Club obviously continues, gets a lot of good press through the 50s. In the early 60s, late 50s, Rudy Inhelder moves to America. And he wants, again, we told this story in the pub before, he wants to meet people like him, not just tattoo people, but also gay men who are into tattooing. a whole other story. But so he thinks the way I can do that, particularly in New York at the time when tattooing was very stigmatized and became illegal in 1961, we could basically, again, I'm going to start my own version of the tattoo club. Bristol Tattoo Club in New York. So he started the Tattoo Club of America, and there's very little information about this. I looked very hard. It wasn't super publicized, but he claims, I mean, I'm sure it happened. I'm not denying that it happened, but basically they had about 250 members by December 1964. And he organized a meetup basically for the Tattoo Club of America. And that is, I mean, all of these interventions so far have been called in various places the first tattoo convention. This is even closer, I think, to something that, again, feels more modern, partly because for that, Rudy is actively inviting people to come.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like curating almost a kind of vibe that he wants to bring people together.
And this is another evolution of the tattoo convention. Now we're taking another step where we're having someone taking a curatorial role.
Yeah, and for him, you know, for him it was a way to again, to meet the tattooers that he wanted to meet, to bring people together. October the 5th, 1964, there's so little information about it that I've been able to track down. I don't even know where it was. It was in New York, but I haven't seen any photos that are definitely from that event. I know some of the people that were there, like Elizabeth Weitzel, who had become a real staple of American tattoo conventions for a long time after this, who tattooed by Burt Grimm, who became known as like the kind of grandmother of American tattooing. She was there. But again, that often gets called a tattoo convention. I in my new book, I call it the United States' first true tattoo convention, although again, it hasn't got that kind of public face in the same way. Yeah, so I don't know. Like, I don't know if that is the I mean, I'm calling it my book, so I probably should decide before I edit it. I think that does feel like a kind of tattoo convention again in this kind of meetup of tattooed, because it's not just artists meeting together; it's artists and people with tattoos, but it's not really public facing. So that then really, I think, brings us to like what does get called, you know, is on the Wikipedia. Yeah, and therefore it must be true, for example, the first tattoo conventions. I mean, there are a couple of other precursor things that get called this, like Kate Hellenbrand, who, you know, very, very briefly worked for Ed Hardy and trained for a couple of weeks with Sailor Jerry. Like, she describes a meeting in Hawaii as the first tattoo convention. This happened in the early 1970s. It was basically Ed Hardy, Mike Malone, Kate Hellenbrand going to Hawaii to stay with Sailor Jerry because Kazuo Ogure was over from Japan. And that meeting of artists, Hellenbrand has called on occasion the first tattoo convention. I don't really think that counts at all, because I don't think there was any public there. It was just some, you know, a big important group of the best tattooers in the world potentially hanging out.
Also, that it's like, it's much more of like an informal event. This isn't something that is like necessarily like, you know,
you're not selling tickets to
You're not selling tickets. And also, it's different in the sense of like the meeting of the Bristol Club in the Horseshoe, that like, this is this pre-planned event where there's a competition and there's also an element of publicity as well.
Yeah, and I mean, there are a couple of other equivalents. Like Al Shafley, inspired by his trips to Bristol, like starts his own tattoo club. He works with Milton Zeiss as well. They start a tattoo club and they have a couple of meetings where people are attending. One of the kind of key distinctions that gets made, and one of these is the international part, right? So does it matter that tattooers are coming from abroad? And of course, certainly at that 1955 London event, Al Shafley was over from the US. I don't know for certain, but I would imagine that there were some foreign tattooers at that 1964 Rudy event, because he was very connected in with European and English tattooers. So again, it's difficult to know where you draw these lines, but I think like, and what counts. But yeah, the real sort of most conventional answer to like when is the first tattoo convention is 1976. A tattoo convention that's held in Houston, Texas. And yeah, it's hosted by Lyle Tuttle and a tattooer called Dave Yerku. And it's sort of gone down in history, really, I think, as this sort of first, you know, first major tattoo convention. So this was a period which has been called by Alan Govenar the Tattoo Renaissance, partly because of this. Lyle Tuttle had been on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, much to Sailor Jerry's chagrin, in 1970.
Jerry was giving out so many of those cards.
So many of those cards. But, you know, again, so although tattooing was coming into public view again in the late 60s, early 70s, it was also that, again, as I put it in my next book, like increased visibility, increased popularity brings with it increased scrutiny. And so, for example, tattooing is banned in New York, and then bans follow in other cities in the US, include other states, Florida, Oklahoma, Indiana, Massachusetts. 1969, there's a prosecution in England of a tattooer who was tattooing 13-year-olds, and it wasn't illegal at that moment. I mean, this happened in 1965, I think. The law which followed came in 69. There was no law tattooing underage people, but this guy got charged with essentially, you know, grievous bodily harm. So tattooers in the UK and England were worried of like, okay, there is a line somewhere where what we're doing is legal or not legal, but we don't know where it is.
Yeah, yeah. And because the it's kind of that situation where an industry isn't big enough or generates enough revenue for the government to pay attention to it, therefore it kind of flies under the radar. So they are in that precarious situation of, we don't know necessarily what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do.
Yeah, exactly. And the savvy kind of old guard of the industry, who are by this point connected through things like the Tattoo Club of America, they realize that something's coming. And although Rudy inhaled the Tattoo Club of America had folded, Spider Web in New York had formed a new version under the same name, partly to try and fight the ban. Tattooers realized if they wanted to stop being regulated and stop being banned, they had to show the world that they were a professional, serious industry. And so again, conventions were a way for people like Spiderweb and Lyle Tuttle to show the world and Yurku to show the world that they were serious.
And it functions in the same way that like any kind of established industry has a kind of trade show. If you're in the automotive industry, there's automotive trade shows where every manufacturer is there. You can go and look at who's making the newest seat belts.
Right, exactly. And actually, again, that dual function is, again, something that they've been very good at. So the writing's on the wall. And so Tuttle and Dave Yurku, Yurku's running his own club called the North American Tattoo Club at this point in TAC, which was a club primarily for artists. He basically said, quote, at the time, "We wanted to get rid of the drunken sailor image." You know, as I said, it's only the first international tattoo convention in a limited sense. Al Shafley had been in Bristol and London and, you know, various other things. But
It kind of highlights as well this contradiction that is at the heart of the tattoo industry as well, is that, like, how can you exist as both an underground and kind of counterculture thing while also existing in the mainstream?
Yeah, and this is something that I am writing more academic work on as well, and something I touch upon in Painted People, like, and something that Margot de Mello talks about in an article she put out in the 90s called Not Just for Bikers Anymore, where she argues that tattooing needs both of those things at once. It needs to be safe and respectable, because that's the way you keep the cops off your back and the tax man off your back. But it needs to be dangerous and cool, because it is, actually.
But that is the main marketing point. Is
exactly
that, like,
this is the point that DeMello makes, yeah.
You know, you need to be acceptable enough that you're not getting regulated out of existence and you have customers coming in, but you need to have that edge as well to make them want to come in.
Yeah, and this is what I think, and I argue this in the new book, in the limited format I'm able to in this kind of book, but I argue really that this is the big contradiction at the heart of the tattoo renaissance. Because on the one hand, you know, history is hailing this as, like, all the tattooers would go to art school by the 70s, and, you know, tattooing's now in Rolling Stone and in Art Forum and the Venice Biennale. But at the same time, it's only there because tattooers are making an active effort to make that happen, because otherwise they're getting, like, I mean, there was a serial killer in the 1960s whose name escapes me,
Richard Ramirez.
Not Richard Ramirez. There's also this guy like Richard Speck, who'd murdered 8 nurses in 1966, and he was identified because he had a Born to Raise Hell tattoo. So tattooing, particularly in America, is in a really, I mean, in England, it's sort of treated as a bit of an eccentricity still. And in fact, a lot of the discussions around the ban in 69 are complicated by the fact that members of the House of Lords have tattoos.
And it also highlights that, once again, this contradiction between the viewing of tattoos in the US versus the UK, and in a way that's similar to a lot of things, is that, like, a lot of things in the UK that in the US are treated as kind of on the fringes, in the UK are just treated as, like, a little bit bawdy.
Exactly.
And a little bit like vaudeville.
Yeah. So anyway, like, this Houston event happens, and it's sort of pitched quite deliberately as a publicity event. It's unclear, like, some people say 50 people went, some people say 150. The Chicago Times, who turned up, said, "Bikers galore, big beefy killer types with their backs and arms covered with skulls, panthers and gross obscenities, which would make the average housewife blush."
This is kind of like the famous Sex Pistols gig in Manchester or Salford, whereas, like,
yeah,
you know, there's probably about 50 people there, but, like, thousands of people say they were there.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, also, I think people that I found who were there say there were 50, and people, like, the press say there's, like, 150. So, I don't know. Split the difference.
Press hyperbole as usual.
Hyperbole. But then they said, but there were plenty of housewives, and they didn't blush. So, the very, very first tattoo convention, you see things that is still coverage of tattoo conventions now, of like, oh my god, there are women here, right? Like, this is fucking nearly 50 years ago. There was also interestingly that, like, that they had a competition, a black woman, this woman called Valeria Watson Deuce, who went on to be a really interesting fine artist, was crowned best tattooed woman. They got a big splash in Esquire magazine, in fact the cover of Esquire magazine. There was a big presence from a cool Austin, Texas underground magazine called Action Magazine. And at that event, there were British tattooers, for example, and European tattooers. So, but yeah, so this is like, you know, this is really hailed as this kind of the birth, right? The other people that went, Manfred Kors, friend of mine, and his mentor Sammy, Tattoo Sammy Horst Schreckenbach, were there. Sammy did feel that first event was quite introspective, so he had this similar idea of wanting to kind of promote tattooing to the world, and was sort of, you know, amazing inventor, member of the Tattoo Club of America, very kind of interesting pioneer in piercing as well. He turned up and basically felt that the whole thing was a bit too introspective. It was all the competitions was a bit too much of the in crowd congratulating each other.
It's a little bit navel gazy,
and not enough, as far as he was concerned, talking to the general public, really doing this kind of advocacy work that this was supposed to be doing. And he, for a couple of years afterwards, made that criticism directly to the organisers, like, you know, come on, guys. But basically, this sort of proved it worked. And then the next event, and this is maybe where we'll finish up, if we're doing this as a two-parter, the next event is the following year, and it's the second international tattoo convention. It's in Reno, Nevada, which has the benefit of being nearer and closer to California. California had become this absolute kind of wellspring of incredible post-war tattooing. And yeah, basically was again, something that Ed Hardy called in his book, like, the first opportunity we got to see the new tattoo. So this is organized by, again, the North American Tattoo Club, this guy Dave Yerku again, but also in collaboration with an English organization called the ITAA, the International Tattoo Artists Association, run by a guy called Terry Wrigley, who tattooed up in Scotland, as well as other places, but mainly in Scotland. And Wrigley was, again, one of these key network members. He'd been a member of the Tattoo Club of America. He'd been a member of the Bristol Tattoo Club. The ITAA was a club, unlike those other clubs, just for tattooers. And again, Wrigley wanted to get involved because he saw the writing on the wall. So he wrote at the time in their magazine, yeah, he said, "We need an association to protect ourselves. It's funny, but the British Hang Gliding Association was formed last month. And hang gliding being popular in the UK for only 4 years. If an association hadn't been formed, hang gliding would have been banned. But because the newly formed Hang Gliding Association was formed and gave an assurance it would police itself, hang gliding is allowed to stay legal in the UK. At a time when more and more local authorities want to ban tattooing, it would seem to be a good idea that the ITAA should police itself in regards to badly ran and dirty studios. How we can do this effectively," he foreshadowed, "can only come about by discussion at the convention in Reno."
That I think is the most times I've heard the word hang gliding.
I know. When I was copying out that quote to use it in the book, I'm like, he says hang gliding too many times, but that's what he says. So tattooing was saved because of hang gliding.
Yeah, there you go. But once again, like, it is that thing where we're seeing all these elements of the modern tattoo convention slowly start to gather together. It's like a meeting of people with collective interests, both as artists and enthusiasts, a element of publicity, this kind of regulatory pushback that, like, they see this is they're kind of getting penned in terms of regulatory issues, and it is in the same way that like the automotive industry or any kind of commercial industry has these kind of conferences to have a kind of mind share of opinion. They're doing that as well.
Yeah, it is also, don't forget, a bit gatekeepy.
Yeah.
Because you can see there, it's like, we have an idea of what tabling should be, and you're either in or you're out, right? Because we're drawing the rules up now. And you can see, I mean, this happened, this is one of the reasons, for example, that modern art exists, right? Because there was the French salons and the American art salons in their wake, and people like Duchamp weren't able to show their conceptual work in those, you know, in the early 20th century, 1917, and a few years before that. So like, there is also kind of a gatekeeping thing here.
Yeah.
Who's the cool kids? Yeah. Who's part of our club?
Yeah. And I think that's where we're going to leave it today.
Oh,
I think.
Cliffhanger for Houston. Okay.
Yeah. So
for Reno. Okay. Good. Yeah.
We will pick that up in our second part of this history of tattoo conventions in 2 weeks' time. If you want to hear it early, maybe check out the Patreon. If you're already a patron, you're probably hearing this the day we're recording it. For everyone else, you've heard it 2 weeks later. But with that in mind, I want to thank all of you for listening. For anyone who's hearing it on the Patreon, if you're going to Brighton, booth 109, we have shirts, posters, postcards, stickers. You can just have a chat with us. Matt will have books. You can also get tattooed by Sammy Hellroy tattooing out of Jesse Knight's Best of Book, and you'll also be able to buy a copy of Jesse Knight's Best of Book. And as always, we have Patreon. Like I said, you can hear episodes like this early, you can hear bonus episodes, and I also have to thank our £10 and above patrons. You can subscribe for as little as £3, whatever really works for you. But without further ado, a special thank you to Stephen McCann, Roy Hoxema, Morpheus Ravenna, Chris Block, Charlie Lightning, Baba Vextra, Shit Jesus, Reed Forden, Lupe Calderon, Garnica, Kirsten Wright, Kathleen Burkhardt, James Schick, and Dylan. Thank you. No. And thank you to Matt. Matt, do you have any housekeeping for the end of this episode?
Only that I'm looking forward to seeing you all at Brighton. Thank you, Tom, for doing all the organisation, sorting all the shirts, sorting out all the printing. I'm excited to chat to everyone about tattoo history. Well, I'll be showing some, like I did at the London convention, showing some archive tattoo film, all kinds of fun things, and obviously I will bend everyone's ear off. So I know some listeners came to the last convention that I was at, so it'd be awesome to see you all.
And thank you for listening once again, and it is goodbye from me.
Bye. Thank you.